United the racist with truth instead of dividing them with lies. We're also rebuilding the family by rebuilding the man. I am Jesse Lee Peterson. Welcome to the show. It's Wednesday already. It's Wednesday, folks. March 8th, 2014. The year is going by fast. Lots of stuff to cover today. In the third hour to the guests, we will be talking to Representative John Kavanaugh out of Arizona. Arizona, you do not want to miss that. And we're going to talk to a young man about evolution versus creation, or creation versus evolution. In the second hour, top of the second hour, and just truckloads of sound bites and just emails and all kind of stuff to deal with today. How can you know the truth? Too much information, cutting through the clutter. That's what we're going to do today. There are atheists all over now. They're everywhere. They're invading us. The atheists are taking over, so it appears. I have with me in studio Dr. Daniel Finca, and I've spoken with him a couple times at least by phone, so he's traveled around. Dr. Finca has a PhD in philosophy from Fordham University. He offers private online instruction and counseling in philosophical problems. He has two blogs, Camera with a Hammer and Empowering Ethics. His recent premiere new podcast, Hammering Out Ethics with Dan Finca. Dan, good morning, sir. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome to the studio. I'm glad you're in studio today.
Yeah, this was great. I had this idea of coming to LA, and then out of nowhere, a friend asked me if I would officiate his wedding in Arizona. And I decided to sneak over to L.A. while I was in town.
And this is your first time here?
Yeah.
How do you like it?
It's great. I'm waiting to be cast in a movie any minute.
You just moved to Florida, you told me, in this past January from New York.
Yes.
You couldn't stand the liberals there?
No, it was. It's just very expensive to be switching careers into my own online teaching. I'm finding my own students now.
Yes.
And so, the New York rents were a little bit much for that.
Apparently, man.
Yeah.
And the liberals have taken over New York. I mean, it's a mess. I want to talk to you about several things, but what is your blog, Camera with a Hammer, with hammers? What's that title about? How did you come up with that? Those titles.
Well, I wrote my dissertation on Friedrich Nietzsche, the atheist philosopher. And the idea that I took two concepts from him, and it takes a little bit to explain, but I'll try and be quick about it. He has this idea, he has a section called The Three Transformations of the Spirit. And in the first transformation, we have to become a camel. And the camel...
Like the animal camel.
Yeah, like the animal, the camel. and the camel is like a beast of burden, right? It takes on great challenges to like prove its strength. And the way he describes the camel is it goes through the muddy waters of truth, he casts it as a kind of animal that's so committed to doing what's hard that it will like abandon the cause at the moment of victory rather than be triumphalistic. And so he represents the camel as this sort of ideal of being so committed to truth and morality that you're willing to endure and you're not willing to take any kind of low road. And then what happens is the camel transforms into a lion, and the lion has to say no to the dragon of thou shalt, right? And the idea that the dragon of thou shalt is this concept that the camel has been told in the beginning that all created value is already fixed, right? There's absolute values. There's no room for change and rediscovery about values. And so in order to say no to that, the camel has to turn into a lion that says no. And then finally, then the lion, though, can't be constantly saying no in life. Can't just be saying those are false values. You have to become a child, and the child creates new values. And so I see this as a nice metaphor for what I went through, because I was a believer. I was a very religious and morally person whose morality was grounded in Christianity. I was very devout in that way, and that's what made me so committed to truth.
Yeah.
And then when I realized, when I thought that the values, the absolutism, the absolute values of Christianity were was a myth, then I had to kind of go through the stage of saying no to that, the lion stage, and then become the child.
Amazing.
And of creating new values post-Christianity.
And now that you do not believe in God, where are you getting those new values from?
From an investigation of human nature and what it means for us to thrive as people.
How do you get values from human nature?
Well, the way I look at it is that we can look at what our nature is in terms of the various powers that constitute us, right? Like we are our reason, we're our emotions, we're our social nature. We, you know, we have these sides of ourselves. And when they thrive, we thrive, right? You don't just have your reason, you are your reason. So when you thrive in your reasoning, you're thriving. So you have an inherent reason ethically to want to thrive in all of those
powers.
But
human nature is evil.
It's not evil. That's only one part of it. It's just that we're not perfect, right?
I'm sorry?
Well, it's not, we're not evil. It's just that we're not perfect.
What's good about human nature?
What's good about human nature is that we're able to, in many cases, care for one another. We're able to build societies. We're able to discover things, build technology.
That's good about human nature?
Sure. We're able to create excellent things.
You think that we're able to do that of ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, well, we're able to do it with the natural powers we have and with our cooperation as a community, pooling all of our talents together.
You said that a change comes over time in your introduction just now.
Yeah.
And how does that change come about?
Well, that's a really great question, right? That you mean, how do we develop ethically?
Yes.
Well, we develop ethically really through a process of experimentation. You know, humanity thrives the more that we're all cooperating in the kinds of ways where we'll give up certain short-term micro-level benefits to ourselves for the sake of the long-term and the macro-level. And what,
but
you know,
humans
it's training us to do that.
They don't cooperate with one another.
Well, we do enough that we have sewage systems and, you know, we have the airlines, the planes aren't going down every day. The flight traffic controllers are very scrupulous. Doctors are working. It's a one-sided picture to ignore all that and say we don't cooperate.
You, at one time, you are an atheist now.
Yeah.
And you, Dan, at one time believed in God.
Yes.
You absolutely believed in him.
Yeah.
Completely. How do you know that you believed in him at one point?
I devoted my whole life. I went to a Christian college and studied the theology, and I had religious experiences and fervent emotional experiences, and I prayed, and I sacrificed my sex life in order to be, you know, pure as I thought God wanted. Like, every one of my behaviors, every one of my thoughts was a testimony that I believe.
But that's not necessarily belief, though. You can learn to do those things. You can be taught to act that way. That's not necessarily proof that you believe in God.
Right, but I guess the question would be, if those aren't the proof someone believes something, that they live by it, that they try and teach others about it. I tried to convert all my friends from the time I was 12. Why would I do that if I didn't believe it?
But you were taught that, and I want to get to your article too, a very interesting article, by the way.
Thank you.
You believe that because your mother taught you that, and she took you to church, she trained you to believe that way. It wasn't of your own free will that you were believing those things. And so that's not real belief.
Well, I would say that, yeah, I mean, if you want to say that it was an inherited belief rather than one that I came to on my own,
yes.
I did get it through the church, as
right.
most people do, yeah.
So is it possible that you have never believed in God?
No,
the reason
not
that you were able to turn away from him.
No, I mean, if you were to say that, then you'd have to invalidate everybody who, you know, and most people who convert to Christianity, they convert when they're children. Most people become Christians as children.
And which is a big mistake, by the way.
Okay, but the thing is, if you wait for people to be adults to first introduce them to this stuff, there's much less likely going to take. The reason Christianity spreads is it gets into the immature mind.
We're not supposed to cause our children to convert when they are children because they already have a relationship with God. Matter of fact, what happens when you force that on them, they turn away from God.
But I'm not talking forcing. I wasn't forced.
if we were a living example as parents, then our kids would stay on course for the most part. We'll pick up on this.
Okay.
Right after this break.
Thank you.
Back in a moment, folks. Okay, folks, welcome back. We will get to your calls at 888-77-5373, 888-77-JESSE. Dr. Daniel, or Dan Finker, is here, and he is an atheist. I want to go back to the question. So
yeah.
Is it possible that you have never believed in God, and that's why you were able to just walk away from him?
No, that's impossible. That's not the reason why.
Because you have never believed him on your own. As a child, you were taught by your mother, and you were taken to church by your mother, and the preacher taught you, and you made the decision when you were a child that you wanted to be a Christian or believe in God. And so you were influenced from an outer source rather than influenced from an inner source. So is it possible you never had that real relationship with God?
Well, I mean, most of our beliefs come from other people. You know, most of them come through that process. So there's a difference between what you believe and why you believe it. And so I definitely believed it enough that it defined my life. I mean, I lost friends over trying to proselytize people.
Right.
I mean,
because you were doing it by rote and
no,
not from the heart.
No, I was.
And a lot of Christian, run people off because they've learned Christianity. Exactly. And it's not from the heart, so they end up doing it the wrong way and running people off.
No, I see, like, it was from my heart just as much as anybody else. If, you know, it was completely out of this motivated love of other people, didn't want them to go to hell. I loved God. I thought he saved us. I mean, I saw it all. I mean, I had a very, very positive view of God. I was in love with God. That was never the issue.
So if that's the case, was it doing you good in your life to have that relationship with God?
Well, there were pros and cons to it.
Yes or no?
Well, it's pros and cons. Good, some bad.
So you had some good and some bad doing that relationship with God.
Yeah, I think that having that sense that the world made sense to me, that there was something to strive for that I thought was of value, that sort of told me that things were important, go work towards them.
At the time, did you believe that God was good?
Yes.
And so you believed in God,
yes.
You believed that he was good, and yet you turned away from good toward nothing. How can that happen?
Well, what I thought was God just didn't exist, and I realized
you think that God did not exist at some point?
Well, because once you look at the biblical stories, you can realize that they're mythical and, you know, not very plausible as true accounts of reality.
So you're walking down the road, reading another atheist materials, and you realize, wow, there is no God. I'm believing it's a good that doesn't exist.
That was a long process, but that was the ending conclusion.
Amazing.
I mean, it was very hard to come to that conclusion. The very first time it hit me that I might become a non-Christian was devastating, and I couldn't process it, that the thought was actually there. But that's where my intellectual conscience was leading me.
So why would you trust the thought that it was telling you the truth? Because thoughts are very deceiving, all of them.
Well, if you
None
say
of
that,
them are true.
Then why do you trust your thoughts about God? Aren't they also deceiving?
Very good question. I was hoping you asked that. I do not trust my thoughts about God because I realize none of my thoughts are of God or about God or from God.
So God might be evil.
Nor are they from me. I trust revelation. God reveals. He doesn't give thoughts.
Okay, but then again, when you say God reveals and you're thinking about that revelation, what if...
You don't need to think about it. Once he reveals it to you, there is no thought about it. It's clear.
See, okay, but then what you're doing, there's no way you can verify that that's from God and not your own thoughts. There's no way you can verify that that's actually from God and not just your own thoughts you're calling God.
I don't need to verify it. I can see that it's true.
Well,
when he reveals to you, you see clearly that it's true. There's no doubt. There's no questions. There's no thinking about, because the light, when it is revealed to you, you know that it's true without thought.
Now, for centuries, human beings tried thinking that way, and they tried just asserting whatever they thought about the gods, and we didn't make the progress.
See, that's the problem. You can't try to do this. Of yourself, you can do nothing. So the less you put into it, the closer you come to it.
But what humanity has figured out, the reason we're able to be on the radio because we've learned about radio waves, or the reason we're able to have computers because we learned about quantum mechanics, or the reason we're able to build societies that manage people's needs in efficient ways, the reason we're able to do all this is because people were rigorously checking their thoughts. We can check our thoughts by evidence. We can check our thoughts in terms of whether or not they're conceptually clear,
logically
consistent.
How are you able to check your own thoughts?
Well, you use standards of logic.
Do you create your thoughts?
Thoughts emerge in our brains.
Do you create them?
Depends what you mean by you. Does my brain do it? Yeah. My brain generates thoughts.
How does your brain generate thoughts when the purpose of the brain or the function of the brain is to cause the motor of the body to react?
Right.
To react. It doesn't create thoughts.
Well, yeah, sure it does, because sometimes
how does
it's
your
helpful.
Brain, how is it that your brain can create thoughts?
Well, that's a neurologist question, right, how that exactly happens.
But, so you don't know how that happens?
Well, I mean, I'm not a neurologist. I'm a philosopher.
So you do not know how it happens?
No, but what we
so
do know.
So why do you believe that it's true?
Well, because let's put it this way. If we were, like, when people have brain damage and particular parts of their brain are damaged, they're gone, then those kinds of thoughts go away, right? Like, those thoughts don't stay in some immaterial soul. Like, if your emotion processing goes, you can't process, you don't have the emotions.
But let me ask this. Tell me, how do you, because I want to get some calls, I want to talk about before I deconverted my dad and my God.
Right.
Interesting article.
Thank you.
How do you, Dan Finca, create thoughts?
Again, my brain creates the thoughts.
So you don't do it?
No, but what we can see is that when the brain's damaged, the thoughts go.
Does
so
the brain
thing.
Do your brains create good and bad thoughts?
What I would say is this. We have to remember that our brains evolved in a very different context, right? We evolved to live in the plains. We evolved under circumstances.
I know, but answer that. Get the bad and the good thoughts?
Well, what I'm saying is that what happens is our brains developed to interact with a world in a very complicated way. So they have thoughts that come in, and some of them are going to work in our modern context, and they're going to be right, and some are going to be false. Our brain generates various sorts of beliefs.
Why would the brain create false thoughts for you?
Well, what the brain is trying to do is make sense of reality, and it seems like it's pitching out hypotheses, right?
You really believe this?
Why not? Why not? Like, you
the
know,
brain
you,
is
you
a
think that
physical
thoughts are,
yeah. thing that fades away in life. It doesn't even stay with you.
Right, but so does thought when it fades away. If you damage that physical stuff, the mind, that those mental parts go away.
That's just a saying.
No. If you damage a frontal lobe, someone loses their decision-making ability. It doesn't magically stay in the ether.
That's all like maybe a good thing. Because if you don't
damage the human brain?
I know what you're saying is true. In that, at some point when something happened like that to your brains, that you're no longer subject to the thoughts. But you should be living that way without damage to the brain.
You should be surrendering your mind?
No, I mean, you should surrender the thoughts.
Right, but you see, when you say surrender the thoughts, how do you choose where to surrender them? If you surrender them to just the tradition about God that you've grown up in, that tradition is old and could be totally wrong.
You don't surrender them like that. You just become aware of them.
Right, good, but you become aware.
So that you can learn to doubt them, and then you can believe in God.
But when you doubt them, the way to doubt your thoughts is logic, right? Is to test against the world.
That's not the way to doubt your thought. The way to doubt your thought is through observation. You just become mindful of thought. That's it.
Okay, wait.
Nothing else is required except for prayer.
All right, so if you thought that there was, if you heard a noise outside and you thought it was a dog, wouldn't the way you would check be to open up and look? And if there's no dog there, and if there's no reason to think there was, then you would give up the thought that there's a dog. You check your ideas with evidence in that case.
No.
No,
I mean, in that
check?
Particular case, you do, but that's a physical thing.
Okay, but the point is that we can go through many of our thoughts and use logic and observation.
Do you know that people who believe in thoughts are insane or going insane? They end up walking down the road.
You'd have to define believe in
crazy,
thoughts.
They live in psycho homes and hospitals and all that kind of stuff.
That's if they believe
kind of
in thoughts just emerge in their brains without evidence.
People. Can I hold you over?
Yeah, please.
Okay. 888-775-3773. Okay, folks, we will get to your calls in one moment here. Let me ask you, Dan, how do you know that you are an atheist? How do you, at one time you were a Christian, how do you know you're not jumping from one conclusion to another one? At one point, you believed that there is a God, and now you're jumping to another point of believing that there is no God. How do you know you're just not jumping from one thing to another one?
Well, because I know all the reasoning processes that would, you know, continually confirm this new belief. So I'm always reinvestigating. I'm always looking for arguments, but I don't see any good reason whatsoever to think that the interactive God of the Bible, who interacts with history and gives people truths through a Bible or tells them things, you know, directly. There's no evidence for any of that, or there's no good evidence.
How do you respond to the Old Testament? It says that a fool says in his heart that there is no God.
The Old Testament also says it's a good idea.
No, how do you respond
genocide.
To that? How do you respond to that?
It's wrong.
That's wrong?
All. It's just false. I mean,
how do you know?
Well, because I'm not a fool, and I don't think that, like, look, 80% of philosophers, 83-something percent of professional philosophers, the people who are the most studied in how metaphysics works and how knowledge works, 83% of us are not theists. I don't think we're all fools, and I don't think it's motivated in
our
hearts.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah.
Are you 100% sure?
No, not 100% sure, but that's not the bar for how we know things.
Was there ever a man named Jesus?
I don't know, maybe. I'm not a historian, so I don't take an opinion
on that. So it's possible there was a Jesus?
It's possible, sure.
It's possible. I want to ask, and then we'll get to some calls. This article, before I deconverted my dad and my God, what are you saying there?
Well, in the article, what I try and talk about is a lot of Christians will tell atheists that we don't want to listen to your reasons for not believing. We just know that you must have some issue with your father. And so what I wanted to talk about was how simplistic that is, that there are a number of different ways that people's relationships with their fathers can either make them believers or not believers, or just shape their vision of their idea what God is or who God is. And then that's totally separate from whether or not there's good evidence for God or not. And then in my own case, I just talked about how I didn't have some terrible vision of God because of a terrible relationship with my dad.
But your dad did not believe in God, right?
No, he was agnostic. He was somewhere, you know, in the middle, and he did, you know, he got baptized while I was a teenager, but he was always struggling with it. But what was key is that when I had a conception of God as a believer, I didn't say, oh, my dad was terrible, therefore I have a terrible idea of God. I was extremely loved by my parents. There was no way I ever doubted for a second I'd be unconditionally loved. So it made perfect sense that when I projected God, imagined God, because no one ever actually has a face-to-face conversation like you and I are having with God, we have to project ideas and we have to make a composite person.
But you can never imagine God or project God.
No.
It's only an imagination. Imagination is impossible for the imagination to project or imagine God.
Well, you keep saying that God says to you or that you know God's thoughts, and what I'm saying is, to me, what I think was really going on there, because I felt the same way at one point, and when I look at it, I realize, well, that's really convenient that God was always a mixture of what I thought the church was teaching me about God, and emotionally I processed God as being very much the way my parents were, people who would unconditionally love me. Everything they told me they wanted me to do was for my own good. I would obey them out of love and not out of fear. So I didn't have any sort of terrible... That was the way I saw God. I never thought I could lose my salvation. I wasn't one of those people who thought
God
was...
You were closer to your mother than your father, though, right?
In some ways.
In most ways.
You could say that. I don't know. I mean, I was close to him in certain ways. Some of us are just different to parents.
So were you closer to your mother or your father?
It's hard to say. In different ways, closer to
each one. It shouldn't be hard
to
say. You know which one you were closest to.
I mean, if I had to choose, yeah, I was closer to my mom and that I could probably...
Not if you had to choose. The reality is you were closer to your mother than you were your father.
Well, you know, during high school, I lived with my mother, and I talked to my dad, you know, on the phone for like an hour or two a week.
Right, because they were not together, so you were closer to your mother.
In that way, yeah, I was closer physically.
Is it hard to say that you were closer to your mother than you were your father?
I just don't want to make it sound like I wasn't close to my dad because I had a kind of bond with him.
We need to speak the reality of it so we can understand where you're coming
from.
Sure,
I was
the reality is you were
not
close to your father because you guys didn't live there. You were closest to your mother because she raised you.
In some ways, but I also had in other words, if you think of how many people you sit down and have a quality hour-long conversation with a week, it's not that many. And my dad, even though it was an hour a week, it was a very important hour.
So you think that all you needed from your dad was 1 hour a week?
I mean, he had raised me very well. I was already 14. whether or not it was ideal.
So you think that spending 1 hour a week with your dad by phone was all you needed?
Let me tell you this. How many kids hear from their dad every week?
Do you personally think that was all you needed?
As it turned out, I think I did okay that way, yeah. But remember this.
How many kids, stay with me.
Yeah.
Do you personally, Dan Finka, believe that as a kid, all you needed was 1 hour a week by telephone with your father?
In high school? Define need.
No, answer the question. You know what need? You have a PhD. You don't know what need means?
Well, you can mean several things.
So you don't think that affected your life in any way?
No, I don't think it was negative. No.
It affected your life in any way not being there with your father, but 1 hour phone conversation with him
When I was in high school, that's the only time it was like that. And no, it didn't.
Isn't it interesting in that your father was a non-believer, right? He did not believe in God.
Yeah.
And you started out, as your mother did, believing in God. So you had her ways then. You believe what she believed. And in your adult life, you become like your father that you don't believe in God. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, but it's a coincidence.
No such thing.
Okay. Well, I mean, I have both their personalities, but it was my dad. My dad has the much more analytical sort of temperament where he would be much more technically accurate.
But isn't it interesting, though, that as an adult, you don't believe in God, as your father did not believe in God?
Yeah, well, we're both skeptical people, sure.
Yeah. And did you tell your mother you no longer believe in God?
Yeah.
Is it possible? And what was her reaction?
She always says she doesn't like it. She was kind of in denial for a few years. She kept saying I'd find a nice Christian girl and it all changed, right. But it wasn't happening.
Is it possible that, and I thought about this last night as I was reading through this, is it possible that you rebelled against your mother because of the type of relationship you guys had and went to war, whatever it is that your father believed? Is that possible?
Not at all.
Then why would you turn away from what your mother taught you?
Because I learned philosophy that was much more critical than what my mother knew.
I think you have an issue with the parent relationship, and you don't want to admit it, because I can tell you, I can see that you're more like your mother than you are your father, even though you believe what your father believes. 888-7753-773, 888-77-JESSE. Back in a moment, we're coming straight to the calls, folks. Let me ask two quick questions, and then we'll go to the calls.
Okay.
One is that you said that when you were younger, you had this void, and a youth minister, two youth ministers fulfilled that void for you, or filled that void.
I don't know if it was a void, but at that time in my life when my dad moved out, I was very intensively discipled by one youth minister, and my older brother was a strong role model. He was also a minister.
And they filled that void.
Well, they supplemented what my dad was doing.
So it did affect you when your father left.
Well, it didn't. Maybe partially it was because there were other role models I had, sure.
The truth is is that no other person can fulfill a void of a father. They can't do it. Now, they can guide you or be there to help you and advise you, but only your earthly father or your heavenly father, your creator, can fulfill that void. No other physical personal thing can fulfill that void.
I don't know. I mean, different people's psychologies are different. I wouldn't reduce everyone to the same.
No. I'm telling you, they can't. It's impossible. Because when God created you, he gave you your father, and your identity is coming from that. Your spiritual identity is from your earthly father. That's why in order to really know God, you have to love your earthly father because he represents God on earth. And if you don't love your earthly father, you're never going to know God.
See, that's what bothers me when you say something like that is that there are a lot of people with very terrible and abusive fathers, and people use language like that to tell them there's something wrong with them when they
there
don't
is
love their fathers.
Wrong with them.
But no,
there are a lot of people
wind up blaming
who are
the victim of abuse.
There are a lot
that's
of
the problem.
There are a lot of people. I venture to say maybe even more people who have been abused by their mothers as well.
But it doesn't matter. The point is when you have someone who's been abused by their father
right.
and you tell them that they have to love their father,
they
there's
do.
Something wrong with them. But no, they have a right to be able to distance themselves from a bad father. And when people
they
feel
have,
the oppression of a father who's bad to them, this is something where people need the emotional freedom to not feel like they need that person.
They have a right to maybe not hang out with the father or the mother who is abusive, but they do not have a right to resent them.
Even if they were committing incest,
if they were committing incest,
that's a heinous thing.
Whatever they did, because what causes them to go insane and emotional, like as you were speaking of, is the fact that they resent the violator. If they didn't resent the violator, whether it's a father or a mother, then they wouldn't go emotionally insane.
You are blaming children for their fathers raping them.
I'm not blaming children for their fathers and mothers raping them. I'm blaming them as adults for holding on to that resentment. I realize as children, they don't understand how not to resent the violator. But when they
Why shouldn't you resent the violator?
Because when you resent the violator, you become subject to the violator. You, in many cases, you end up marrying the violator or one that look alike, the one that violated
but
you.
But you are making
or
clear.
Or you end up, whatever, with the violator. You become attracted to what you hate. But if they didn't hate the violator, then they would not have the mental and emotional pain that they have, and they would not be subject, nor would they be attracted to the violator.
Well, that's a whole complicated thing. But
it's
I
not
think
complicated.
To,
it's quite
well, it
simple.
Is. Well,
forgiveness is the way to go, not to resent it.
If forgiving will actually help the violator
not if,
heal,
it does.
But many violator. But the problem is though many victims first need to learn that they're it's okay for them to have their anger. It's fine for
no,
you.
No, it's not okay.
Well,
it's
no,
absolutely never okay to have anger.
Even if someone violates you.
Right. Because anger only hurts you.
No.
You notice how you became a lot like your mother because you resented her.
I didn't resent my mother at all.
You resented some of the things that your mother did
mother.
To you.
No, I didn't.
No, you don't love her.
No, I love my mom to pieces. The only thing I ever said in that whole article about not loving my mom was only that when it was time for me to become 11, 12, 13, I didn't want her to smother me. But other
right.
than that, we have a
your
very,
mother
very close
was a very smothering person.
She was not a smothering
and you
person.
You resented that, and that's why
it's
you became
false.
Like her, and now
we're
you're trying to get
close.
Away from her by becoming an atheist, and
you
it's
see,
not going to work. When
see,
has
you're
answer
ignoring,
this really bad.
You're ignoring
when
all
has
my arguments
hate,
to say that.
When has hate ever help cure someone?
I'm not saying hate.
When has resentment ever help cure someone?
What I'm saying is this.
No, answer that.
Resentment helps when someone is recognizing there's a problem. The feeling of resentment is a way of realizing an injustice is happening. And that's a good thing.
No, that's not true.
Yes, it is.
When has resentment ever helped to cure someone?
Resentment has...
Give me that answer to that.
Well, resentment has...
You can't find it anywhere.
No, of course you can.
Where?
Of course you can. Well, look at any time that there's a social movement for justice for an aggrieved group, it starts with resenting the mistreatment as part of it. Now,
but that doesn't help.
Yes, it does,
it
because
doesn't.
It motivates to
no,
a certain extent.
But give me an example when resentment has helped cure anyone, or anger,
look,
or resentment, which are all the same.
If someone owning the fact that they have a right to
They don't
resent,
have a right. You don't have a right to judge anyone. And resentment is judgment.
You have a right to resent being mistreated
no,
as a step towards taking as a step towards asserting yourself.
No, you don't.
I'm not saying to hate.
The best way to assert yourself is not to resent.
No, because there are some people who are so cowed, they are so bullied by an authority figure like their father, who they feel like
or
they cannot
mother.
Question, or their mother, doesn't matter. You know, they feel so cowed that they cannot even resent. But for
no,
someone like
they,
that to realize...
The reason that they feel cowed is because they do resent. Because resentment brings on fear.
No, because they blame
when
themselves.
You have fear, no. When you have fear, you are. It's because you are angry. It's because you are resentant.
But you're angry for a good reason. Anger is because you've been violated.
No,
that's a good,
good reason
to be angry.
There's no good reason.
Sure.
Not resenting does not mean
you can't
blame
just throw
yourself.
Out our whole emotion of resentment.
No.
You know, the emotions are fine. The problem is how we use
emotions
them has to be the most constructive. Yes, they are, because our emotions
the only
are...
All the way emotions can be fine... If they bring you to a point that you realize you need to forgive, if they don't call you to realize that, they're no good to you.
Wait a second, but what about the emotions that bring someone else to realize they're a wrongdoer?
No, that's backwards.
No, the problem is that there are many people.
No, that's backwards.
There are many people who abuse others and refuse them their emotion of resentment.
When
they
I come
call
back,
them bitter.
Call us. When I come back, we're going to take your calls. Evolution versus creation is coming up next, folks. You do not want to miss it in the second hour, the top of the second hour. If you're not getting the Jesse Lee Peterson radio show, by way of radio in your town, go to bondinfo.org, bondinfo.org, and continue to listen live. Two more hours to go. Dan, your contact information.
camelswithhammers@gmail.com. And if you write me there, I can give you information on taking classes with me. And the blog is called Camels with Hammers, and the other blog is called Empowerment Ethics.
I highly recommend you take a second look at your resentment against your mother and,
I have no
and the
resentment
lack of father,
my mother.
And so that you can forgive them.
I don't resent my mother.
She smothered you.
I know that.
And you tried to get away from
11,
her physically.
And then we stayed close for all these years. We're very, very close.
Right, because you have no other choice right now.
No,
you resent her.
It's normal
so
for an adolescent. It's normal for an adolescent.
You're there by guilt and not by
No, I'm not at all by guilt.
Free choice.
It is normal for an adolescent to assert themselves. That's all I was
referring
to.
Let's take the Bible go-to guy. But if they're doing wrong, why you need to assert yourself against your parents?
It's just because they're doing the right thing.
Because
they're not perfect. They overdo a little bit. But
Bible go-to guy, welcome to the show, sir. I'm sorry we have about 3 minutes here.
Oh, 3 minutes is plenty. thank you. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
You know, listening to you two go back and forth kind of reminds me or takes me back. It makes me think I'm in a time capsule listening to Paul argue, you know, the Apostle Paul argue with the Athenians or the Greeks, you know, with their great philosophies. And his philosophy destroyed theirs based on one thing, and you're missing it. And Jesse's putting it right in your face, and that is you're a hater. You respond, yeah, listen. You two were arguing about whether or not it is better to forgive or to resent someone who's done wrong to you. Well, that's the whole crux of Christianity. And all your little logic system, oh, I'm going to use logic to go against, you know, to prove out my thoughts. You know, you can know something by logic is completely wrong, but do it anyway. That's called evil, because there's something powering you, and that's your resentments, your hatreds. That's giving you the power to go against what is logical.
No, that's not true at all. I mean, what I was talking about is that our emotions guide us to give us information. They're helpful in that guiding us, and that if when someone is harming us, that is simplistic. That is simplistic to say that it's logic versus emotions. Forgive me.
Not only are you a liar,
no,
I mean,
I'm not
hater,
a liar.
You're a liar.
Bible go-to guy, please.
Everybody knows emotions go against logic.
You know, talking over me doesn't prove you right. Please listen. What I'm saying is that emotions and logic are not these opposite poles. We have emotions, and then we have to think logically about them. Sometimes they guide us towards what is right. Sometimes they need to be corrected for. But when someone is hurting you, it is appropriate to have a response of resentment towards the harm.
I got to run. Dan Finkel, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. I do appreciate it.
Creation versus evolution coming up next. Back in a moment. And breaking news.